The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And today, it's host talking to host, the host of Wine Talks with Paul Kay. It is Paul Kay, of course, the owner of America's oldest wine club, the original Wine of the Month Club, started by his dad back in the early 1970s. Paul, thank you so much for being part of the podcast.
It is a huge honor. And yes, it's host to host, which... We understand each other that way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. It makes it easier. It's certainly, yes. It's two gas bags with wine knowledge. You obviously right. Have more than me. And also, Paul, I mispronounce everyone's name and your podcast and everything. It's just with Paul Kay. But at least once for the listeners, can you pronounce your name that is more difficult to say than Gewürztraminer?
So. That's why I went with Paul Kay. It's really Callum Carrion, but I say it's Paul Kay. The rest is silent.
Callum Carrion. That's not too Callum hard. That's
12 letters.
So first, I'd love to go back a little bit about your history and starting with your dad. How much did people scoff at your dad for? It's like 1968. Your dad starts a Wine of the Month club. Everyone is always confused whenever anyone does something new before. We're always skeptical of it. So what skepticism did your dad go through?
It's a very good question. He didn't have any skepticism, actually. When he came up with the idea, and my father was a very academic guy, he still is. He's 92. We talk wine and all kinds of things still. He's very active. But he actually, when he came up with the idea of getting out of retail, manning the counter is what sort of inspired him to do mail order, but he was still a prolific retailer. He had 6 pharmacies and a liquor store or wine shop at that point. But he actually sat down with the great names of wine critics, wineries, and asked their opinion. And he drove all over LA, actually went to Napa and sat with some of these guys, Norman, Nathan Croman, Bowser, all these guys, and said, I have this idea. And what do you think? And he got very positive comments on trying this. And if you're not an entrepreneur, you're not a businessman, or you're not heavily into mail order stuff, you may not totally understand the value of it, but they understood the value from the wine standpoint.
Mm-hmm. And so that was 1968?
The store he bought in 68, it was ice and bourbon and ice cream, and he started to convert it into a fine wine shop in about 72, just before actually featured the Mike Gergich first vintage at Chateau Montelain in 1972. So he was a going concern to the world of wine from 71 to 86, and was right in the thick of the Judgment of Paris. The stories are endless.
Yeah, and by the way, the Gergich Zinfandel is one of my favorites. Right there with like Helen Turley and Black Chicken, and you know, just in terms of really good California Zinfandel.
They're great wines.
Yeah, they really are. So, and by the way, going back to those days, I don't know if you remember any of them. The one thing that always makes me jealous is how cheap high-end, classy Bordeaux or Grand Cru Burgundy was back in the 70s and 80s compared to now.
I have... volumes of newsletters starting from 1972 and all the wines we featured. And I still have actually some of the rack. When you took a bottle of wine in my dad's shop and he brought it to the counter, we had a sort of a Rolodex type metal framed index card thing, and we would look at the prices. So I have 2 slates of that still, and they're not Bordeaux, but they're the California whites. They're $239 to $249, maybe even $3. And then the Bordeaux were around $6.49. The first wines of the first 3 wines of the selection for the May 1972 Wine of the Month Club were 4 Chablis. I think they're Grand Cru. They were $6.49. That was a lot of money. That was a lot of money back then for wine. You know, what do we know?
Yeah, but even then, in comparison, just because of supply and demand, and you know, now these wines are enjoyed all over the world versus back then was only enjoyed in like you know part of the world.
That's true.
Yeah. So actually, you know what? Real quick, just to explain to people the judgment in Paris, 1972, what that meant for California wine in terms of legitimacy.
That's a great story. I can get very granular. I'm intimately familiar with the story. I've had Steven Spurrier on my show and the Gergiches and the Beaubert's been on my show. The gist of it is Steven Spurrier, who was an Englishman who owned a wine shop in Paris, decided to hold a tasting at the behest of his American partner in his L'Académie du Vin to just expose French judges to California wines. That's what it started as. It wasn't meant to be anything. And at the last minute, Steven Spurrier decided to make it a tasting, a taste-off, and had to notify the judges as they entered into the Intercontinental Hotel that this was going to be a judgment between French Bordeaux, California Cabs, French White Burgundy, and California Chardonnay. And they agreed. And they agreed because, you know, there's no way California can ever beat them. And lo and behold, after the first flight, which was the Whites, the Chateau Montelena 1973 Chardonnay came out on top. And it befuddled and confused and angered the French judges. And they swept the table and they came out with the Reds. And Mr. Spurrier will tell you, they were hell-bent not to let California win again. In other words, as they're tasting, they are definitely trying to make sure they sort out the French from the American and rank them higher. And it didn't work. Stag's Leap, Warren Winiarski's Stag's Leap Cabernet came out on top. And it's been history ever since. The comment has been made to me by George Tabor, the only journalist to show up. He was on the show too. Is, well, maybe California wine would have evolved in 5 to 10 years. And I agreed with that, but I also said, but we wouldn't be telling this story today. And the story is more magnanimous and more important today than it was even in 1976 when the article in the June 7th Time magazine came out. It was just a single column without a byline. Even George didn't get credit for the article saying what they want. And they don't really, you know, that no one really cared. Mr. Barrett, here's an example. Mr. Barrett, who owned Chateau Montelet at the time, was also a friend of my dad's store, was in all the time, didn't leave his day job until 1984 or 85. Not till 12 years later did it look like owning this winery might be a successful venture and, you know, we can make some money at it.
Wow. That's a great example. And yeah, you're right. It was 1976. I said 72. I probably had the undefeated Miami Dolphins on my brain. So Paul, let's talk about you a little bit. You went to college. You were dabbling in more of a corporate job, but then you came back to help your dad run his store, run the Wine of the Month Club, I believe in 1988. What was your motivation to go from one world to go back to wine and family?
Yeah, great. I was at SC. I had swore to myself, since I came from an entrepreneurial family, my dad had immigrated to America in 1949 and became the pharmacy, the small chain of pharmacy. And not unlike him, you know, you had a choice when you graduated from pharmacy school to be a corporate pharmacist where you were a chemist basically, or you went and opened stores, and that's what we planned to do and what he did do. I swore to myself I wouldn't go to corporate America out of college. I was going to be like my father, but I ended up at Xerox, which is probably one of the largest corporations in America at the time, but with one of the greatest sales organizations and sales training that you could get next to IBM. Worked there for about 5 or 7 years. And then one of those guys pulled me away and said, let's start our own software company, which we did with 5 of us. And we grew to a substantial little company that had a product that was sort of unique and niche oriented. But what that taught me was a no fear in business. You know, it's business is business and you run it and you can't take it personally. And that nothing, you know, I had to, twice, for example, I had to go out on a Friday and find somebody to pay us something to make payroll. So either they owed us money and I had to collect, or I had to go find a new sale and the software was around 20 grand to make payroll. So when you have to do it that way, you know, you kind of learn some street lessons. And my father got an offer to sell the Wine of the Month Club to a South African firm that's still in business called the South African Wine of the Month Club. And he said, before I do that, you may want to come check it out. So I went down to Redondo Beach. I packed boxes. I billed customers' credit cards. I did all the things for about 3 months and said, yeah, I think I can do this. My dad's from Cairo. He's Armenian descent. We're merchants. So the transaction was very short. Here's the price, son. Here are the terms. Good luck. We're all counting on you.
Really? Nope. No pressure there.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
I read in this quote, if you could take me back to this moment in 1988, a few months into you guys, the partnership is done. The two of you went to a Bordeaux wine tasting and you were seated separately on the drive home. You guys realized that except for, I think, two wines, you rated every wine the same. I was wondering, I know this is like, you know, 32 years ago. What do you remember about those early wine tastings, like that Bordeaux one way back in the day?
One thing back in those days, and I'll tell you that was the early days. Now, you're talking 88. So the early days, my dad stays in the 70s. You didn't even taste wines. The salesman would come into the store and say, here's the Mondavi Fumé Blanc, and here's the Sebastiani Cab, and here's the, you know, Matus or Lancers. And that you just bought it and you put it on the shelf. My dad was, and this is substantiated by many of the salespeople that are still around from those days, that my dad sort of created the idea of tasting stuff before it went on the shelf. So nothing went on his shelf that he didn't taste. Then evolved from that, because wine and beer and distilled spirits back then were fixed price. You could only charge one price. It was a fixed commodity. You looked it up in the book and that's what you charged. They started holding these trade tastings, and the trade tastings were either by wholesaler like Southern Wines and Spirits or Young's or Wine Warehouse, which also started in 1972, or it was a regional tasting. So the Bordeaux Institute of Los Angeles or the U.S. would hold regional tastings around the country, and this happened to be a Bordeaux one. It was about 25 Bordeaux. I remember walking in. I was, you know, a rookie. I didn't know much. I've tasted with my dad, but certainly didn't understand Bordeaux at any length. But you have to also understand, we do sort of a meatball surgery ranking. We don't sit there and chew on it, and at least at this level, we give it a score of 1 through 3. And at the risk of exposing my vendors to my rating scale on the show, if I write a 1 next to a wine during a tasting, it means there's no way I can use it. It's either way too expensive, it's just not any good. If I write a 2, the 2 means even at the current price and the quality of the wine is very good, I must look at it again to feature in the club. And the 3 is good wine, overpriced, potentially they can bring the price into what the value is. Because our skill set is about evaluating all the $20 Cabernets next to each other and giving you the one that's worth $40. So that's true. That day we were driving home, we opened our books, and we started going through the 25 wines, and there were only 2 that we did not have the same number, 1 through 3 next to. And he literally said, give me a dollar. And that was his sort of ceremonial sale. It wasn't until after that he sat me down and said, here's the price of the terms. But
yeah.
By the way, he was convinced I could do it.
I got to ask you, are you a fan of MASH? Because when I hear meatball surgery, that makes me think of MASH.
That's where it's from.
Okay. Okay, good. Oh, good. Yeah, okay, so then you are the Hawkeye Pierce of wine.
Well, I do have this funny reputation at the tasting bar, and the reason more is just pure business. Every Tuesday at 9:30, they line up. They have 15 minutes of fame. They bring whatever they want. And I don't care if it's flavored Prosecco or, you know, over the hill cab, it doesn't matter. I'll taste it. Is I don't pull any punches. I have no room or time for it. I don't want them calling me back and saying, you really like this wine. Everything goes in a computer. The database has got hundreds, you know, over 50,000 wines in it. And I'll let them know what I think they should follow up on. And if you don't follow up on it, you know, I may not buy it because I've got a lot of wines in front of me, but these are the wines that I like. So everybody leaves knowing what made the grade, what didn't, and, you know, what to pursue.
Well, let's go to those Tuesdays. So for the listeners, and again, I want to get into your pod. There's 100 things I want to get into, but what are Tuesdays like for you? You try about 70, 75 wines a day. How is your tongue and your palate afterwards? Your ability to spit must be at a Grand Cru level. I mean, tell me about these Tuesdays.
Well, the most important change I've made in the last 30 years is I only taste them once and I spit it out. If I think I can use it, I'll taste it again. So I've actually cut the number of sips I've taken almost in half. That's the first thing I had to do when I started getting old. But yeah, you know, it's not a problem for me. We've been doing it for so long, and we know what we're looking for. There are a couple of wines that might be a little confusing toward the end of the day that I may run a retaste with a fresh palate. But your palate's best between 9 and 11 anyway, typically. So, but what's happened with COVID, because the restaurants are closed, there's a ton of wine on the market. Because if you and I start a winery tomorrow, our first marketplace that we're going to go after is a restaurant, because they put it on their tasting list and they put it on their list and they keep buying without an additional sales call, particularly if it's the house pour of, you know, on their by the glass program. So that's the best thing you can do. In many, many wineries, boutique or otherwise, 70%, 80%, 60% of their wines are going to restaurants. That was cut off, you know, March 16th, particularly in California. So we've been seeing a huge uptick in tastings. And so last two Tuesdays ago, I tasted over 100 wines in that same time frame. And that I was tired, I'll be honest, at the end of that day. That was a tough one. But usually it's 75. And some days, you only have four or five appointments. And then the next days, people are asking to come in after hours because they have so much wine to taste. But clearly, COVID has created a huge problem in the supply chain to provide wines. And people that have never called on me in 30 years, like Silver Oak, which is great wines, are now my vendors. And it's great to have them.
Yeah, absolutely. Consistently good Cabernet. Yeah. Actually, by the way, Paul, you mentioned about having a row of $20 Cabernet Sauvignon and trying to find the one that tastes like a $40. How hard is that? Because I'll be honest with you, you know, all the wines get taxed more that come up here to Ontario with the LCBO. But when I see a $20 bottle of wine, $20 Canadian bottle of wine that says Napa Cabernet Sauvignon, I usually don't trust it because I'm like, how are you going to make a wine that doesn't have too many chemicals or sugar and tastes of what that area is supposed to be? The $20 Napa Cab seems like one of those mythical unicorn things.
Well, that's a layered and complicated question, but the short answer is no, there could be some really great values in that range. And the reason is it's an agricultural product, so it ebbs and flows. You have huge harvests and you have short harvests, and you have, you know, most wine is not made by the estate that grew it anyway. Most wines are farmers. They're all farmers. That's what they do. They grow a lot of grapes and they sell them. For instance, an example, in 2004 in Paso Robles, there were like thousands of acres of grapes that weren't even picked. There was so much grape on so much juice on the marketplace that some people didn't pick it. If you didn't have a contract, you didn't even pick the grapes. So you could run into a problem with doctored up wines and, you know, the 76 chemicals you put in it. If you're buying really cheap, and most end cap store bought wines are like that. They have to be, because every time they got to produce a certain amount of wine, they're not going to be able to get and take advantage of the excess juice of quality wine. So I have a license to make wine. It hangs in Santa Rosa. And I get offers all the time from different appellations across the country, mostly California, of course, of really good juice that's been made by somebody and needs to be sold. It needs to be bottled. And it's a very legitimate, normal way to do business in California. Now, am I getting Screaming Eagle, you know, excess juice? No, that's not happening. But legitimate quality Cabernet, Merlot, whatever, from appellated areas in California, that's just on the open market and available, and, you know, to the best, highest bidder. And that's what I was trying to get through to the Groupon buyers. And like, however you buy wine is great, and whatever you need to pay is up to you. But the Groupon buyers that you're getting 15 bottles for $45, whatever those numbers are, they're making money on that. So they're making money on it. Even after all that, there's margins in it. Okay, why? How can that be? A friend of mine lost a contract to one of these Groupon sellers because he was charging them €2 a liter for the juice. Okay. And he lost the contract to a guy willing to sell it to him for €1 a liter. That's like 85 cents worth of juice in the bottle. If you have to do that every month, container after container after container, it's all crap. It has to be crap by definition.
Yeah.
Because you can't make it for that. But you can make a bunch of Napa Cabernet, get your margins out of it at your winery. Whatever the excess juice sells for, it sells for, it ends up someplace like my winery or someplace else, and gets bottled up at a much cheaper price than what that grape would have cost if it was sort of like first growth, right? I think I calculated the other day, Napa Cabernet grapes in 2018 were $8,000 a ton. Okay, that makes about $175 a bottle right out of the chutes. And that's what you're going to pay $200, $300 a bottle for that wine, like an Opus or something.
Yeah.
But the excess juice of those runs is all, their margins are done. They made their margins, right? It's agriculture. It's just extra grapes. So whatever they get out of the gallonage of what's left over can end up in a really nice wine.
So it's just about seeking out, about finding those quality excess juices, finding, getting access to them.
Yeah, that's why we get to taste all the $20 cabs and find ones that are actually better than what that price suggests. And there, that happens all the time.
Yeah, that's important. I want to bounce back and forth, but I want to hear a little bit more about the podcast Wine Talks with Paul Kay. Why did you decide, what was the motivation for you to start up a podcast? I enjoy the energy of it, the intro. I was listening to one of the most latest ones about the aroma wheel when I was jogging this morning. What was the motivation behind it?
It's multi-tiered, but the primary focus is the exact same focus that my father had when he started selecting wines. The idea was not to sell more bottles of wine. It was not for the Wine of the Month Club back in 1972 to sell more bottles. It was to help the clients and the customers find the good values. And this podcast is meant to expose customers to what wine really is and what it should be, this ethereal drink that makes you feel something and not just necessarily about the cheapest thing you can find. And again, everybody has their motivations. And I think you even saw or listened to in the aroma wheel, you know, her premise and the Dr. Noble's premise, who invented the aroma wheel, is like, yeah, if you want potato chips that taste like dill pickles, you know, we're good with that, right? Because they're sensory people. And that's a whole spectrum of the wine business. That's, look, the woman in front of me the other day at the market that was buying a liter at 1.5 of Sauvignon Blanc from Sutter Home wants that wine to taste exactly like that every time. So that's one kind of buyer. But the podcast is to show people the myriad of facets of the wine business. And you bite off and expose yourself and learn what you want. You know, wine is a study. It's never going to end. You'll never know enough. An MW I was speaking with this morning on a podcast, brilliant woman, she said the same thing. You can never know enough. And so you and I as consumers can know what we like, and that's it, and that's fine. Or we can decide that it's kind of interesting to learn that Oakville is different than Mount Veeder, which is different than Atlas Peak or the Bordeaux regions, whatever. That's what we choose to do. But the podcast is just to show you, you know, what's happening, and an honest goodness approach to asking the tough questions. Well, today the MW didn't agree with anything I said. So and it was great. You know, it was really great because it's a different point of view.
Yeah.
So I want people to learn. And no matter what happens to the Wine of the Month Club in the future, you have no plans, but you know, this industry is such a mess right now. The podcast will continue. And I have a great position because I buy wine. I buy a lot. So I've not had anybody turn down the opportunity to be on the show.
Yeah, of course. And again, it's Wine Talks with Paul Kay. And you can find it on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify. Basically, wherever the people listening to this podcast or any podcast, you're going to find it. And also, Wine Talks with Paul Kay, easy. You're not going to misspell it. Super easy to get. So my question for you, how important is it for you to demystify wine and reduce the level of intimidation people feel about wine?
Yeah, that's a question that we were talking about today, and she disagreed with me.
Oh, what did she disagree with?
Well, I don't really care for bloggers and websites that tell you that. Like, for instance, one demystification would be, well, I'm just going to fill out this questionnaire on this website that says, do you salt your food, drink black coffee, and like mushrooms, and now I don't have to worry about choosing wines because it's doing it for me. That's a bunch of horse hockey, if since you're talking about MASH, right? So I think it should be complicated. And I think it is complicated. It is an important subject. And like I said earlier, you can choose your level of study without being in a position to say you don't know enough. You just study what you want. You know, sometimes people don't want to read about wine. Reading about wine's hard. You know, it's really monotonous to do unless you have a glass with you, right? But I think it is a complicated subject, so there's no reason to say it's demystifying it. It's there's nothing to demystify because there's too much to know and to understand. Like we just moved into myself. I just moved into a really prolific study of French Burgundy. I'm fascinated by them. You know, I'm talking about soil content and all that kind of stuff. Not everybody wants to know, you know, how much lime is in the soil and what chalk soil there is and what happened with the plate changes down, you know, way down below the surface of the earth. That's not important to most people. What's important is what they put in the glass. And so I kind of like listen to what you want to listen to. I do try to stay away from some of that stuff in the podcast. I'm not talking about soil content, but that's, you know, it's an important part of the business. I'll highlight one example. Emmanuel Camigi, a master sommelier, you got it in the 90s. He makes wine. A master sommelier, and I respect wholly the master sommeliers and the master of wines. It's a very difficult degree and requires extensive study. However, he and I were tasting his Purret Spanish wines together, and he says, you know, I was in Sacramento talking to Daryl Cordy, who's one of the great vendors of the wine of the world-renowned guy, really nice guy. And he says, you need to taste this Armenian wine, Emmanuel. So they open an Armenian wine, and Emmanuel's like, oh, my gosh, this is really good. He goes, so now, as a master sommelier, not only do I have to learn about Armenian wines, because I knew nothing about them prior, I have to compete against them, too, because I'm selling wines from Spain that cost more money. So just that alone, just the fact that now Armenia has 54 wineries, that's a whole nother level of understanding you should, if you cared, to look into.
Oh, I have a couple bottles of Armenian wine. I'm sitting them down for a couple of years because they're big. Like they need, these ones need to settle down. Need to settle down a little bit. But by the way, you getting into Burgundy. I mean, I feel anyone who gets into wine at some point, we all go down the Burgundy train, and It's a beautiful place to visit. And I think the thing I always try to explain to people, the craziest thing is you can stand in the middle of that hill. In Côte de Nuit, I'm going to make a second football reference here. You can throw a football as far as you want. And wherever that ball lands, the grapes that it hit, that could be a bottle of wine that is now $700 a bottle. That's and right. You could be standing at $40 a bottle.
That's right. That's yeah. All. The one of the greatest illustrations I've seen from that was Albert Bichot tasting. He brought all the rocks, you know, going down the sedimentary rocks and a big pile of them, which was fascinating to smell and touch. But the key to it is if a route at Chèvre-Jabertin goes down 30 meters or 10 meters, it's touching a certain type of soil. And across the street, that same route going 10 meters, because of the way Burgundy is set up, is touching a different type of soil. And that's what makes the difference between the wines. And that's a complicated subject. I have a client that just spent a lot of money on a lot of Burgundies, and I wasn't confident enough to just call the vendors I'm used to and say, hey, give me some of your best Burgundies. I wanted to know more about them, particularly this guy's cellar. This guy's cellar is like amazing. Okay? He's got everything. And we were at Gavin Newsom's favorite restaurant, the French Laundry, actually.
Which, of course, he wasn't at because you're not allowed to be indoors with a whole group of different right. people. Oh, wait, he was indoor with lobbyists. Nice job, Gavin. Yeah.
Which, by the way, when we were there, which was only a month or two before, the seats inside that room were $800 a seat because it was in the room. If you sat outside, it was $400 a seat, okay? Which Oops. Is really expensive, of course. But the point is, the Somme came over and he goes, what would you like to drink? And all my friends at the table wanted, you know, they like Napa cabs and we're in Napa. And I go, but this is the French Laundry and they don't understand Burgundy. So I told the Somme, I said, look, here's the budget. I think it was $400, which is a lot, and I want a Côte de Nuit and I want a Grand Cru. And so he went to the cellar and came back and they loved it. My guests, I didn't pay for the whole thing, by the way. My friends loved it. And they were asking questions. I looked on the back label, found it was brought in by Atherton in San Francisco, which is a very boutique importer. Talked to that guy. Said, now I have a source of Burgundy that I can trust. I can't trust the local sales rep to bring it. They just want to sell stuff. This guy loves Burgundy. Okay. And so he sent me his list based on what I told him. And thank goodness they were fabulous. And my customer who spent like $12,000 on Burgundies for like 28 bottles, fell in love with them. So,
by the way, that was very mean of what you did with your friends, Paul, because if you turn them on Burgundy, I hope they don't have kids who have to go through university, because nothing kills your wallet more like a love of Burgundy. It's going to get you. Hey, tell me about I have listeners in the United States. I'm sure, you know, I mean, everyone can get your podcast wherever throughout the world, but you're the oldest Wine of the Month club. I'm imagining you can't get access to it here in Canada, but I have American listeners, and I'm just curious if you could sort of explain a little bit your process about putting the wines together.
Yeah, so what's interesting in the last few years, the internet's changed everything, not just from buying and selling, but what people are buying and looking for. So for one, when I took the club over, we had two clubs, one that was like, $20 for two bottles, and the other one was like 40. And that turned into three price-sensitive clubs. And then as time's gone on and the competition has grown and everybody's, you know, you can join the NRA wine club, you can join Williams-Sonoma wine club, you can join the New York Times wine club, you know.
By the way, I bet the NRA wine club, very high alcohol, high body.
Yeah.
I imagine they don't have a lot of 12.5% red wines.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
A Bota bag full of a nice heavy duty cab and a 30-06 and you're in good shape, right? So now though, what we have is more specific clubs. We have a Napa club, we have a Bordeaux club, we have a Pinot exclusive club, which is very high end. We have a sweet wine club. We have the Rosé club, plus my price sensitive clubs. I have an organic biodynamic club. So the granularity of what you can choose is much better than it was in the old days. And that's because the consumer's more educated and they're looking for things. Our biggest compliment is that somebody joins the entry-level club that's learning about wine and calls and says, you know, I'm starting to be disinterested in your wines. What else do you have? And we take them up the ladder of more interesting wines. And that's an important, you know, growth in of your palate to do that. But every Tuesday I taste the wines. I buy about 3 or 4 months in advance, particularly if it's imported, then we have to directly import the wine from overseas. Do that a lot. I have licensing to do anything you want. I can make it, I can vend it, I can wholesale it, I can sell it to a restaurant, I can sell it to the consumer. And I use all those licenses to get across state lines, and unfortunately not across international lines. Canada's really tough.
Yeah, I know.
100% tariff or something ridiculous.
It's horrible. Every time I travel to Europe, when I'm in a winery and I say I'm from Ontario, the look of the face of the wine owner or the winemaker, it's you know, this look of both anger and they feel sorry for me. It's horrible.
Yeah, it's tough. I have a client in I think they're in Montreal, and they are a concierge service for entry level and new professional athletes who have just have this windfall of money because of their talents. And they do stuff like rent cars for them or find them cars. And they like to have this introductory 12 pack of reds that they average around, I don't know, $100 a bottle or something like that. And we were doing a lot of business with them. And so they wanted me to test sending one to Canada. And we went through the whole FedEx thing and we thought we had it figured out. And then it got stopped by the government and the tariff was 100% of the value of the wine and had to be paid before it could be picked up. And unfortunately, a lot of Canadian hockey players didn't get their wine is what happened.
And they're getting into it more. Wine is becoming a status symbol, not just by who could spend the most, but I find out with a lot of athletes, now it's about not just being about cake, bread, and Opus, but it's about Cote Roti and Margaux. And it's about, like, mm-hmm. you know, the ones who sort of understand or at least just have a broader a broader palate. We only have a couple more minutes, mostly because I don't want to take up too much more of your time. But I'm wondering,
plenty of time.
I'm wondering first, for do you ever engage in blind tasting or blind tasting contests?
Only when I put them on for friends.
Yeah.
Just to prove things like the dollar amount is not necessarily the value of the wine. And I do blind test myself a little bit when I'm tasting things. I sometimes tell the vendors, don't show me the bottle, just pour it for me. But that's a very, you know, if you're trying to guess a wine based on the...
I know.
It's almost like, why? What's the point of that? In fact, the master psalm today, and I've heard this many times, and I have many friends that are master psalms that have been on the show. Their primary thing isn't like, can you tell me that this is Zinfandel? Their thing is, why do you think it's Zinfandel?
Yeah.
And justify, you know, your opinion.
Yeah, it's never about the final answer. It's a show me your process to get that. You can get a wine, right? You could say, it's a Zinfandel, but you're calling low alcohol, super high acid, but you're still saying Zinfandel. It's like, wait, no, that doesn't work. The only reason I was asking was, did you ever have a moment where you nailed a wine that you feel really proud about? You got one super duper wrong. I love watching wine tastings. It's a weird fetish for me. I watch wine blind tasting videos on YouTube. I love going down that rabbit hole. It's sad, but I was wondering if you ever had any of these moments.
Yeah, we've done it a few times. I was training somebody a couple of years ago. She was just helping put stuff in the computer. And I said, you know, I want you to pour some of these wines. There were four bottles. I think they're the same vendor, different grapes. And I said, let's just see if I can figure out what's in them. And I got them all right.
Nice.
So that was like, I was fascinated by that I could do that. Then we used to put on a charity tasting. And one of the booths at the charity tasting was exactly that. We set up four brown bag wines and anybody can come up and they pay a little extra money for that and they get to test. And it was, I don't think, even my dad, you know, he was a Chablis thing at the time and he didn't get it right. And that guy's, you know, he's been tasting chemicals his whole career. So, you know, that's just fun part of wine business. Certainly not, you know, I think people misunderstand an MS or an MW can actually do that. I'm sure there's some better than others, but that's not a prerequisite. It's really justifying the terroir you taste or you smell. That part has gotten clearer to me in the last few years. The terroir of a real terroir-driven wine, picking out volcanic soil, picking out loam, picking out chalky soil, has gotten easier, or at least more understanding. And some of the vinification techniques are becoming more obvious to me. It's just, you know, it's just time and tasting. Not everybody gets to taste 100,000 wines in their career. And maybe I should be further along after tasting all those, but that's where it is.
Yeah, but you're too busy to brood over every sip, you know, to really get in deep of what are the tertiary characteristics of this wine.
Can't do it. I can do it afterwards.
Yeah.
Certainly, the meatball surgery part of it is strictly value right out of the chutes.
And I imagine.
It's kind of interesting. If I taste. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Sorry. So finish what you can say there.
If I taste 100 wines on like that one Tuesday, I would have rejected probably 85 of them. And 15 of them would have been good value and probably candidates for the club. But what we found over the years, there's three basic types of vendors. There's winery direct, there's wholesalers, and there's bottom fishing brokers. The wholesale brands, the hit rate's higher. Let's say of 100 wines, I taste, you know, 25 are acceptable. Because why? They have buyers that are checking these things and have a reason to buy a wine and put it on the shelf and represent their company. Wineries also have a very high hit rate. The bottom fishing brokers who just cast the net to get samples for whoever can get it, I mean, it's like as low as like 25%. Because unfortunately, and I think the listeners of the show should know this, if you have spent money, Beaubert told me it takes 13 years to get your money back if you start from scratch with a winery. And that's using a first-year crop like Riesling or something. I mean, you can sell that first vintage, you know, as soon as you make. You don't have to put it in the barrel and age it and wait 2 more years. So if that's the case, and you spend all that money you're going to pick it and you are going to bottle it and ferment it and you are going to bottle it. And if it's not that great, it wasn't expected, you're going to do it anyway because you're not going to dump it down the drain. So maybe you alter it with some chemicals or, like you said, or add some sugar to cut the bitterness down, and then you're going to bottle it or you're going to sell it to somebody else that's going to bottle it. Because it's business at some point, right? You got to make some money at it. So that's kind of why we exist, because all that stuff is put in the bottle sometime, somewhere, somehow.
Is there, the last question for you, is there one thing, like for the wines that you reject, I'm sure there's 100 reasons why, but is there a theme that comes up more often than not in terms of why you give the wine a 1 and not a 3?
The 1 is typically the value just way off the charts, meaning I couldn't even negotiate the price down to where the wine makes sense. Because let's face it, if you're going to buy a wine for $12, it's not going to have the same pedigree and terroir-driven character that a wine for $40 or $100 or more is going to be. It's just the nature of the business.
Yeah.
So the number one reason I reject stuff is typically, well, I'm not even sure that's the case. Some stuff's just not good. You know, a lot of it's just not good. It's too bitter. It's been over-doctored. Figure that out. You know, people will, I've tasted dozens of times where somebody put in some sugar to balance the acid, or balance the bitterness, and then they had to put more bitterness in it to balance the sugar, and all of a sudden the thing's been compounded into, multi-layered crap. But usually when I give it a 1, it's just not pleasant. And the final analysis, this is not complicated, the final analysis on my 2s, is would I take it home and serve it to my guests and my family?
Right.
So it might be really interesting. It might be a really interesting wine from Umbria that just fascinates me because I'm in the business every day. But would I take it home and sit with my family and drink it? Is it a pleasant experience? Sometimes the answer is no. Interesting wine, complicated, complex, layered, spice, the whole thing. But, you know, it's just not something I want to take home. So that's an interesting dynamic that we've come across.
Paul, for people listening, tell again where they can find the wine club and the podcast.
So the wine of the month club is wineofthemonthclub.com. Make sure you put club in there. You get a unfriendly competitor of mine. The podcast is, of course, available on any of your podcast hangouts, but it also is at winetalkspodcast.com. And I encourage your listeners to Google my name once you spell it. So, because over the years, the press has been very kind to us, and we have a lot of high-level praise for the way we do business, not only just the wines we choose. I can't please all the palates all the time, but the idea of what we do and how we've done it for so many years. You know, for me, before we get off, the idea of tasting on Tuesday, I just took it over. And my dad would taste on Tuesdays. My job as a 16-year-old was to set up the tasting room for all the doctors that supported the pharmacies. They'd go up in the loft. They'd brown bag the wines. My dad had the UC Davis 20-point scoring system up there. And they would taste the wines and talk and shoot the breeze. That was Tuesday. And when I bought the company in 1988, Tuesday's tasting day. And blind luck, you know, it's been like that for 30 years. Never have missed a Tuesday unless I was sick or out of town.
Great. And I imagine, yes, luck's involved, but also, you know, hard work and smarts as well. Paul, really appreciate you joining me on the podcast today, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you. And hope we do it again.
I'd love to get you back. I got 100 questions. I want to talk more about natural wine, about, you know, making Bordeaux more accessible, but I have to save that for another time.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me at Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.